First edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Monday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast First Edition also. Hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people, unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up in the second hour of the show, a special Hollywood All-Star segment, taking a look at the 2017 Stellar Awards review. That is the Gospel Music Awards. Got a lot of music, and we have the great Finesse Demps coming back. He is one half of the Hollywood All-Stars and writer for, well, he's and he is Indie Soul Magazine, quite frankly. Calais Avent is also going to be with us. She is she's on staff here at WEAA, and she's a producer and host of Fresh Fire Radio Podcast. It's going to be a good segment on the Stellar Awards. Also, Khadija Ali is going to be here. She's one half of the Dual Inspiration team. So we'll get to that segment as well in the second hour. But in this first hour, we're going to unpack the overdose epidemic, or so-called. And I call it so-called opioid epidemic. And I'm not saying that to disparage anybody or any characterization of what's happening. But I guess the reason why I say so-called is because there's been an opioid epidemic in Maryland for a long time, I think. I think that's fair to say. And obviously, we know all too well, all of us who are from Baltimore, born and raised in Baltimore, that heroin, that Baltimore is a heroin town. And so we're all too familiar with drug overdoses. But there's a man in the studio with me, a friend of this show, who knows more about all of this than anybody else I know. It's Israel Kaysan. He is the founder of I Can't We Can, the recovery facility, addiction recovery facility. Israel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brother Sean.
So let me start by kind of digging into some of these statistics that were reported earlier today. The reporter is, I reached out to that reporter and I didn't hear back. Reporter from the Baltimore Sun, Meredith Cohn, who has been covering these stories, I think over the last year, maybe 2 years. But the reality is that in Maryland, the Maryland Medical Examiner's Office has exceeded the national caseload standards as far as overdoses in the state. Maryland is not the only state that has occurred in, several other states. According to this report, the toxicology lab is running almost nonstop. But the numbers in 2016 as far as overdoses are incredibly alarming, I think, in the minds of most people. There were more than 900 fatal overdoses in 2016 related to heroin, allegedly related to heroin, okay? And there were more than 700 related to fentanyl. Now, in a minute, Israel is going to help us sort through what that really means, because I think the reporting is a little bit ambiguous when it comes down to it. There were statewide in 2016, there was 1,468 deaths statewide in just the first 9 months of 2016. So all of these numbers, as far as overdoses are concerned, drug overdoses are concerned, are up significantly, and it has caused a panic within the state medical examiner's office, and it has a ripple effect, because obviously the Baltimore Health Commissioner, that office relies on information from the state medical examiner in order to devise programs and funding and everything else when it comes down to these issues. So, Israel, let's start. And I invite others to come into the conversation during this hour as we go through this. 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. But something you said to me offline is, I mean, the information is public information that fentanyl is far more powerful than heroin, right?
About 100%. 100%
more, 100 times more powerful than heroin. So given that, as you just stated to me off the air, the suggestion that somehow people are cutting heroin with fentanyl doesn't really make much sense, especially from, you know.
Right. I mean, if you got two opiates and one is 100 times more potent than the other one, you can eliminate the lesser one,
right,
and just cut the powerful one.
Right.
But they keep saying that they're cutting her arm with fentanyl. And that don't even make sense.
Right.
So what they're doing is producing, both of them are opiates, and they are painkillers. And when you cut her arm with the type of cuts that you use, if you're using or whatever you're using, it tends to take away the potency over time. It falls, the car falls, and it gets less potent and less potent and less potent.
Right.
Fentanyl is 100 times more powerful than heroin, so when you add something, it lasts a lot longer,
because
it's got more, it's more powerful.
Right.
So, and people that's doing drugs, they don't know what they're doing. They look at how much they're putting on a hype on a needle. So some people may say, I do a 50 on the hype. 50 or what?
Right.
You don't know what you're doing. See,
right.
Some people are doing just cut. We have people that come through the program and we do your analysis on them. They think they're doing dope, and it's not even dope even in the urine.
So
it'd be all types of amphetamines and different stuff that, other than opiates.
So from what you're saying, as far as a lot of the people that you're seeing come through your program, people aren't even, they're not even getting opioids. They're getting whatever they're getting.
Cut material. And it alters the mind, change the mood. So a lot of people don't even know what a painkiller really do.
Right.
It just takes them off balance.
Right. That's interesting.
But then when you get a potent drug like fentanyl, which you don't know what you're putting in you, or in the hype, or you're sniffing it or what, it could be the same amount, but it's more powerful.
Right.
And over a few days, average heroin would drop, the potency would drop till it's no more good. Now, maybe if you got a whole bunch of heroin that done been ate up by the cut, then you might mix fentanyl.
Right.
But not, you don't go buy heroin and then mix fentanyl.
Okay. All right. So from your experience of what you've seen, what you've heard, what you've seen reported, and what has happened, I mean, specifically within I Can't, We Can. The people who are dying of these overdoses, when you start going out to the outer counties, you know, whether it be on the Eastern Shore or Southern Maryland or Western Maryland or wherever it is, is it your belief that that simply many of these drug overdoses are because these people simply don't know what they're getting into, and even maybe the people who are selling them the drugs don't even know what they're necessarily selling them.
What's one thing about the narcotics is that it's environmental sensitive. If you're in a rural area, there's a different group of people selling them different types.
Sure.
And like in the rural areas, you have black tar, heroin, that's not part of a cartel. These are individuals from Mexico that comes over and set up shop, and they're not hooked to no other group, so they don't have no wars, they set up a delivery system like delivering pizza. You call them, and they deliver it in little small balloons, but they don't deal with no black people.
Okay.
Almost like a raw habit. Yeah. So they got a different habit than all the cut that people get in the city. So you're dealing with, it's very environmental sensitive. So you got people that's doing, they got, in the rural areas, they got real bad drug, heroin habits.
Mm.
And so the doses go up. They start with the pills. The pills get too expensive, and then the Mexican setup, the Black Tar system, and it's all over the board. They don't even deal with urban areas or black people.
So they're just dealing directly and exclusively in rural areas.
Right. You call them up. They're passing them out. You call them up, meet them in McDonald's somewhere, and they have these little balloons with black tar, and they sell them to them like that.
It sounds like what you're saying to me is that they've created a totally different system of distribution.
But this has been going on for years.
Okay.
You know, the urban area don't know this. The ones that do the cartel and the killing and all that, they mostly serve urban areas,
right,
and they fight for that area, for that territory.
Right.
These are independent Mexicans.
Okay.
And they got places in Mexico that make the drug, and they send illegals over here to set up shop, and they're not connected to nobody.
So they're independent agents.
Right. Each one of them is independent, and they go around and they sell their drugs to whatever area they set up in, but they don't fight over territory or none of that.
So when it comes to, I mean, and this may not be, you know, directly in your area of expertise, but when it comes to law enforcement, it seems like it makes it that much more difficult.
Right, because they lined up to come over. They catch them. Now they it took a while for them to find out how they was doing it. Mm. Now they started off in Arizona and places. Now they all across the country. Mm-hmm. And it's already set up. So they just keep, they lock them up, they just keep sending more. And this don't have nothing to do with a drug cartel. Mm. So they don't have any problem getting it across the border or setting up shop. It's just like families, little family, independent families.
Wow. This information has not been really readily available, I don't think, in the reporting that I've seen.
What the reality is that you're dealing with a lot of different environmental sensitive ways of dealing with narcotics, heroin. The bottom line is this didn't happen overnight. It started with OxyContin and that would, they used to have pill factories in the rural area.
Right.
Baltimore have a different system of using drugs. You know, they get heroin and they cut it with quinine and mannitol, and it's a whole together different type of. Right. And then some people are putting more cut on it, and then they start adding different things to it, and a lot of people don't even know what narcotics is.
So what you've seen in Baltimore from your perspective with I Can't We Can, is it your belief that there are as many or percentage wise as many overdose deaths in Baltimore City as there are in the rural areas, or is it actually typically more in the rural areas now as opposed to years ago?
It's always been more in the Baltimore.
Okay.
There's never been an epidemic because we accept it as a lifestyle.
Right.
So we didn't count that as, that's normal for us.
Right.
As many people as dying, that's kind of normal for us to have. But now that we adapting really from what the rural areas, and now they're doing the fentanyl in the city. Hmm. And we're not used to that quantity of drug. Because we're used to the heroin with all the cut on it.
Right.
And now the fentanyl is cheaper and it's more powerful. And people don't know what they're putting in them.
So that's part of the reason why I said when I did the intro, the so-called opioid epidemic, because as you just said, heroin deaths, overdose deaths have always been more in Baltimore City than anywhere else.
Anyway, because we're the urban capital.
Right.
But we have accepted it as a lifestyle, so it's no epidemic. It's
right.
Normal.
Right.
But other places, they can see what they can become by looking at Baltimore. Now, that's what makes it alarming, an epidemic, because that's what they headed to.
Right.
They can see their future by looking at Baltimore. Mm. We don't want that as a lifestyle.
Right.
You know, most of these kids got money, their parents got education, and now everybody's affected. For a while, it lasted, you know, till they ran out of the little bank accounts and the cards started getting missing, and then
right.
more money. Now it's affecting the whole family, but it's in.
Right. Let me go back a little bit as far as these last few years, Israel, because I think that one of the things that we traced back to The reporting we've done on this on First Edition is that there was a major, the pills, oxycodone and the other pills were always rather expensive. And then there was a drop in price in heroin. And so there was a glut of heroin, so people were trying to get rid of it. And so that's where some of these kids in these rural areas began to turn to heroin. And then this fentanyl became injected into the equation. And that's where these overdose deaths started to skyrocket or spike in these rural areas. I mean, that's my understanding of like how it played out.
No, everybody gonna wind up buying the bootleg drug,
okay,
because it's progressive and chronic. Your shot goes up, and when you're dealing with the pills, it's basically $10 a milligram, whichever one it is.
Okay.
25 milligrams is gonna cost you 10 times 25, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you buy the quarter, but it's going, if you do one pill, it's going to take two pills to do the same thing that one pill did.
Okay.
Because your body adjusts to it, and then you have to take more and more and more, and eventually you can't afford it. Everybody automatically going to be going to. So this was like supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
You create the demand, then you supply it. They was already ready for this.
Mm-hmm.
This been, well, the pill boom was started in the 80s, and they had pill factories. And from pharmaceutical companies, and they didn't know how to regulate it. And so doctors, the illegal doctors got lost their license. Anybody, any kind of doctor could open up a pharmacy and get as many, and people were going buying pills from the pharmacy.
You know, it's really ironic that you mentioned that. Today there was a report that came out that said that Prince, who died of what we believe was a painkiller overdose,
mm-hmm,
last year, had his whole crib, the whole right. crib was filled with
in his pocket. He had money. It was fentanyl. He had packs in his pocket when he found him on the elevator or whatever. And because your shot goes up, you take more and more and more. And after a while, you're gonna run into trying to satisfy your habit. You're gonna do too much.
Hmm. And that's what happened to him.
Right.
They said that there was literally
a lot of times. When you're doing drugs, it just ain't just the drug. You got to factor in fatigue. You got to factor in rest. You got to factor in nutrition. All that contributes to overdosing on something. You know, all that has a part to play.
Well, and that was one of the reports that came out when he was on a plane and had some trouble before he actually died. They said, "Oh, it was fatigue." But given his—
That's part of it.
Right. Given his schedule and what he was doing, I guess that makes sense, right?
Right, because I know for myself, I OD'd at least 20-something times. And I know that I could do the same thing if I wasn't running or doing, depends on what I was doing. But I know what causes OD a lot of times. You'd be tired. You'd be, right. All that plays a part.
We've got a few more minutes in this segment. I want to get to your backstory in the next segment. But to finish up on what we're seeing here in Maryland and across the country, are you seeing people who are old, or rather who are become addicted or in rural areas in across the state, whether you want to say the Eastern Shore, Southern Maryland, Western Maryland, whatever, are you seeing those people come to your facility?
Well, yeah, because now we have facilities in the county.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, when did that start?
Well, we have a facility in Carroll County.
Oh, okay.
Another one in Carroll County. Then we have one in Howard County. And we're putting one in Anne Arundel County. Because the county is asking us to come.
Wow. So,
because, and we know that, I know that, it's in, this treatment is environmental sensitive. You can't treat people in rural areas with a different type of habit. Because behavior has a lot to do with the drug that you drug of choice,
right?
You know, and lifestyle,
right?
You know, it's a different type of lifestyle. You can't medicate your way out. You can't police your way out. You can't legislate your way out, and you can't incarcerate you out of this condition. The only thing you can do is change the lifestyle, and that's gonna have to start with the young people, the babies and the kids, because it's easier to build children than it is to repair adults. Once they hook, there's no cure for learned behavior. Now you got to teach them a whole new lifestyle. That's why I came weekend as a holistic therapeutic community. We deal with the whole person And the main part of a person is not just the physical, psychological, and social. The main part is called spirit. That gives everything meaning and purpose. And a lot of times we'll get clean, but we leave the spirit out. Mm. And without a purpose or meaning, you go back to your learned behaviors because there's no cure for it. You can only arrest it.
Mm. Right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Israel Kaysan, the founder of I Can't We Can. We'll talk about his backstory and talk about the history of heroin addiction in Baltimore City as we look at this so-called opioid epidemic across the state and really across the country. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Here on WEAA 88.9, I'm Sean Yoes, your host, in the studio with our friend Israel Kaysan. He is founder of I Can We Can, the addiction recovery facility in Baltimore, in West Baltimore, now moving out to different counties, clearly. Israel, you just before the break, you told me that now the counties have contacted you and asked you to come and provide your services that you provide in West Baltimore and several counties. Talk about how that's been happening over the last, how long has that been going on?
Well, they've been having a problem for quite a while. Huh. And that's not just in the county. I've been invited all over the world. I go to Bermuda, Malaysia, different places, because the people got a problem that they're not used to. They don't have a clue about what addiction is.
Right.
And it's affecting really the whole world. And so they know that eventually, by looking at Baltimore, what their community can become. Mm-hmm. They can see themselves, because this is what happened to Baltimore. And this is why it's a panic, because now they're feeling the effects of it.
Right.
And so they call us, because that's what we deal with. We deal with addiction, been dealing with it all the time. But we deal with it as a lifestyle. You know, it's a lifestyle change that we try to, they just want them to stop. You just can't stop. So really they're not prepared for the holistic approach of dealing with an addiction. But they know what the result is going to be by looking at Baltimore.
So your argument, and it's one you've had consistently, is that it's not necessarily about the drug or whatever. It's about that lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
Yeah.
See, it's supply and demand. They create the demand, then they supply it. You take away the demand, then you can make all the fentanyl you want. But if there's no demand for it, nobody's want it, then it's just going to sit there. Mm-hmm. So they created the demand for it. Now, that is centered around a way of life now. You live to use to live. And everything you do, now the drug is running your life. The drug is telling you what to do. And you just can't tell a person the drug is more powerful than you talking. You have to put a person into a structured environment where there's no cure for a learned behavior. They have to unlearn a behavior and put a better one in the place of it. Mm-hmm. That takes practice and time.
Well, how did fentanyl even become, you know, a part of the conversation? How did it become introduced into
fentanyl,
culture?
It's not a new opiate. Okay. I mean, it was so powerful that the only way they could put it in you is through a patch.
Okay.
That was for like cancer patients that's terminally, that was just in total pain.
Just trying
they would
help.
Put a patch on them.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, like the morphine pump. They was using that for pain. But then they came up with the fentanyl that's 100 times more potent. But it was for like terminally ill people who was in severe pain. And the only way they can put it in them is through a patch that goes through their skin because it was so powerful.
Well, now how is it?
Well, they're making it now. They're making it in, you know, creating it in labs and different places and tons of it. And it's simulated like that now. Mm-hmm. And now it's still as potent, but now you can cut it. You know, they don't come in a patch. People used to take the patch and try to squeeze the fentanyl out of them, you know, but that's the only way it could, they would allow you to put fentanyl in you because it was so powerful. Now you had to put a whole lot of cut on it, and you can easily miscut, you know what I mean? But not put enough cutting agent on it. And you used to a certain amount of opiates. All of them are opiates. This is, you know, and that's nothing but a painkiller.
Right.
It's four basic types of drugs, uppers, downers, painkillers, which are narcotics, and mind disorders.
Right.
So the narcotic is, it can be simulated because it affects the same, the receptors of the brain that the, because your body naturally produces opiates. And this is simulates the opiates is in the body that that latches onto the receptors in your brain like the natural opiates do.
Before we continue the conversation, I would invite callers if they have questions for Israel, as far as the reason or there any questions that they may have about addiction, opioid addiction or otherwise, and about what's transpiring. I mean, part of the reason we're talking about addiction right now with Israel Kaysan of I Can We Can is that the state medical examiner has exceeded the national caseload standards because of opioid overdose deaths in the state. More than 900 fatal overdoses in 2016 were related to heroin, according to the state. More than 700 related to fentanyl, according to the state. 1,468 deaths statewide in the first 9 months of 2016. Overdose deaths statewide in the first 9 months of 2016. They're calling it an epidemic, but if you listen to Israel Kaysan, he'll say that we've been dealing with this type of overdose scenario in Baltimore City.
Well,
for
half
decades.
Of those in Baltimore,
right,
versus the whole state,
right.
But we never had an epidemic,
right.
So
right, and yeah.
But see, because all deaths have to come through University of Maryland at the coroner's office.
Right.
They count them all as overdoses in Maryland, but half of those belong just
in Baltimore City.
Right,
right. So the thing is when they state that it's a rural issue and it's just a rural issue and that's why it's so much attention. But the reality is that there was always kind of this level of death.
We accepted it in Baltimore as normal, you know, and so they never did nothing. To quell the overdoses in Baltimore,
or maybe it wasn't that sense of urgency because there were people of color who were being killed, who were dying because of poor people and black people,
and we accepted it too.
Exactly,
we accepted it as a lifestyle. It's like it's normal for people to die OD because they're doing drugs, but so they never did nothing about the drug use.
Right. So let's talk a little bit, Israel, because I think it's important to talk about the history of heroin use in Baltimore City, because we talk about the fact that Baltimore is a heroin town and has been. But can we talk a little bit about the progression of how the drug and the use of the drug in the city has evolved over decades? Because, I mean, and part of your backstory, obviously, is that you were addicted to heroin for 30 years?
Yeah.
You sold, you used. And you have evolved to the point, literally ascended to the point where you now help people, you know, recover, and you help them change their lifestyle through I Can We Can. Mm-hmm. But let's go back and talk about how the evolution, if you will, for lack of a better term, of heroin in Baltimore City, like from the 1970s.
Well, even before then, heroin is an opiate and it's a painkiller, and it kind of it start off as a benefit. People could play music better. They would socialize better, and you could have a long run on heroin, like a long run on alcohol, because you didn't need it. Wasn't all these agents, cut material in it.
So it was more pure back then.
Yeah, because you know when I first started doing heroin, I could spend a dollar, but I only put up every four of us, 25 cents a piece. We get a dollar pill. And all of us did $1 pill, and it was a small pill. But when Nixon came along and they stopped, I guess when Frank Lucas got knocked off because he was bringing all the raw heroin in,
right. There
was an epidemic. Nobody couldn't find heroin. So they started creating all these synthetic heroin cut, and people were putting, and that's when people started getting abscesses and getting addicted to cut material, amphetamines and all different stuff that and the pills got bigger because you had to have a whole lot of garbage. And so now a lot of people don't even know what heroin do. Don't know what heroin. All they know is alter the mind and change the mood. So when you get a painkiller, it feels so good, you know, that you don't feel. And once you only get high one time, the rest of the time you're chasing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. So a lot of people might have gotten high, and but now they're chasing a lifestyle.
Right.
You know, it's just want their mind altered and mood change. So people are doing everything: crack, dope, cigarettes, coke, everything. And it didn't used to be like that. Alcohol, they're mixing everything together just to alter their mind and change their mood.
But your point historically about the fact that the purity was altered in the 1970s when the Nixon administration came along, on what purpose was it? I mean, in your mind, did that happen?
When
the purity was changed, when the purity was altered.
Well, a big part of it was Frank Lucas.
Okay.
And the war, because they was bringing in heroin.
Right.
I don't think he was the only one just bringing in heroin.
Right.
You know, because heroin, you know, a pound of heroin is worth more than a pound of gold. Mm-hmm. So people would trade it just like money. Mm-hmm. So same way with the cocaine. They was using cocaine to finance different things, mm-hmm. you know, wars. And so when the war is ending, you know, a certain market may stop.
Right.
But the customers still got the habits.
Oh, true.
You know what I mean? So now that was a panic. You know, you could go in. We went all over the country trying to find some dope, mm-hmm. but then they started making synthetic dope or making stuff out of different other materials,
right.
And it took a lot of it. So some people their body started adjusting to that type of drug, whatever it was mixed up in it, called a lot of cut. You know, a lot of people do dope. You really don't feel nothing if you did raw dope. But then they look for a feeling, and it'd be the quinine or whatever the cut is. And they associate it with being dope. Mm. And it's not even dope. Mm.
So let me take a phone call real quick. We have a caller on line one. I'm not sure how to pronounce the first name. Can you press?
Yeah.
Northeast Baltimore. How you doing? You're on with Israel Kasey.
Fine. I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, thank you for calling. We appreciate it. Appreciate you.
Thank
calling.
You. It might be a crazy question, but I just wanted to ask Israel, how can the cut dope heroin, can it cause someone to lose or be losing their sight by using cut or uncut heroin? Can it cause someone to lose their sight?
You don't have no uncut heroin. So whatever's in the heroin could cause any. People find stuff in the medicine cabinet to mix with different things just so people can get that feeling. And a lot of they're doing heroin, and they're not really doing it. Scratch head of raw heroin. So the rest of it is cut. So it depends on what they're cutting it with. Mm.
Deirdre, thank you for your question. So the point is, though, I mean, we're not talking, I mean, the drug game in Baltimore or in the rural areas of the state is an imprecise science, obviously, depending on who you're dealing with.
Because they don't have no control.
Right.
They don't control the drugs in the street. And, you know, in the street now, whatever you buy, you just get. You don't get your money back. You don't.
No.
You used to now. You could go to somebody.
Okay.
Because if you put a cut in raw heroin, it only lasts 3 or 4 days. And then they would tell you, yeah, it fell. You know, they give you something new because they know that it fell. Then when they sold one off the top, one off the bottom. One on top, one on the bottom, and so they can tell you. But they knew that. And you could get a refund.
But to the point of Deirdre's question, I mean, if you don't know what's in it, you mean
right. It ain't the heroin, you know, because heroin is just a painkiller.
Right.
When I used to cut heroin, you can OD and know you out because you don't feel it. Mm. It's the fumes get in, so you had to wear masks and all that. Mm. But you don't feel nothing. You feel no pain. So when you're feeling something, that's not the heroin.
Right.
That's cut.
Right, because it's logical. If heroin's a painkiller, then of course you don't feel anything.
You don't, right. That's why you have to wear a mask when you cut it, because the fumes, you don't know you high.
Right.
You just don't feel, and you'll pass right up.
Yeah. So you talk about how the journey from being someone who used and sold to someone who eventually got to the point where you wound up helping people recover from addiction. Because when you talk about addiction, it's not always drug addiction. I mean, it's all kinds of addictions.
Right. You won't understand. See, I'm talking in hindsight. I practiced some things that were suggested, and in hindsight, I understand it now.
Right.
I can explain it, but as you're going through the difficulty, you can't explain it.
No.
You can't explain it until you understand it. So that's in hindsight. So in hindsight, I can tell you everything about the drug, and I can tell you about a new life that I never had before because I already know how it is to live an addictive-centered lifestyle. Now, in recovery, it's totally different. So if a person in recovery, they're not going back because they have choice. You choose to live. And recovery is enjoyable. But if you don't have a choice, a man with only one option don't have no option.
Right.
You have to make sense out of whatever life you're living. So I had to go through the difficulty of finding a new lifestyle. Going through that, now I can give you the contrast of both lifestyles and tell you how you get from one to the other because I did it.
All right. Well, you told me what the breaking point was for you. I mean, you can say it as cleaned up as you possibly can, I guess, on the air. But, I mean, it literally took a really dramatic situation and someone literally, you know.
But to see the moral of that principle is that didn't have no purpose then. I'd hated it when somebody did that. It didn't have no meaning, no purpose. But as I began to go through the recovery, now I thank God for that. Because my whole past has purpose now.
Right.
But it don't have a purpose until you get a source that gives everything meaning and purpose. That's called spirit.
Right.
We don't have that spirituality. So we can get clean. We can go to all the treatment. If you don't have spirituality, then your life is still meaningless. And you'll easily get back, make sense out of what you always done. You got to have a contrast. God created everything in duality. You don't know what up is until you've been down.
Well, you're right about that, bro.
You know what I mean? You got to have both. Everything is duality. Ain't no left without no right. And the same thing, if it's a benefit, then there's a consequence. But we always see one way in addiction, and we're chasing a benefit. It's a benefit in doing dope. It's a benefit in doing crack. It's a benefit in drinking. But it's the opposite to that. It's called consequence.
Right.
So you have to learn if the benefits outweigh the consequences. If you only have one way of thinking, then everything is a benefit, so you're going to keep chasing that one thing and ignoring the consequences. But the consequences are going to show up because that's reality.
Exactly. It's inevitable. If you just are tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I'm in the studio with Israel Quezon. He's founder of I Can't We Can, the addiction recovery facility in West Baltimore. Israel was addicted to heroin for 30 years and eventually evolved to the point where he was able to help thousands of people recover and change their lifestyle. We're talking about addiction because of the new report coming out that says that the state medical examiner's office has exceeded the national caseload for standards. And actually faces loss of accreditation if the situation is not resolved. In 2016, there were more than 900 fatal overdoses statewide related to heroin, more than 700 related to fentanyl, which it becomes a little bit murky because, I don't know, the two aren't necessarily interchangeable, but they have been seemingly in many cases. And then there's 1,468 deaths statewide in the first 9 months of 2016. The overdose deaths, half of those deaths or half of those heroin overdoses were in the city of Baltimore specifically. But let's go back to what I asked you, Israel, as far as making the transition from the lifestyle that you were in to being able to help people literally recover from addiction. And it took you getting to a breaking point, like most people. But until you just made the point, until you find an alternate reality, so to speak, you have nothing to compare what you're dealing with, right?
Right, right. You have no contrast.
Right.
So you make sense out of wherever you're at. in order to have a reference point, you had to have some place to start. Then you had to have a comparison. And if you don't have recovery, then you don't know what recovery is. Then you make sense out of your addiction, and you make up stuff that's in your addiction, and that becomes your reality. But it don't change the consequences.
Let me ask you this though, Israel. I mean, as you said, you have counties calling you now and asking for you all, and have been asking you all to come out and help with addiction and what's happening with people who are adopting the lifestyle that we've seen so prevalent in Baltimore City. What are you seeing as far as the mentality of people who are addicted? I mean, is it different in these rural areas than it is in Baltimore City, obviously it's a cultural difference, but I mean, does it force you to change your approach? I think I already know the answer to that, but I mean, I'll ask the question anyway.
Well, addiction don't discriminate.
Right.
It doesn't matter how you get addicted. The principle's still going to be the same. It gets worse. So how bad it gets, it depends on what you have. Sometimes it's blessed to be poor and addicted. Mm. Than to be rich and addicted, because now you have enough money to kill yourself with. Mm. You know, a lot of people think they get clean and they stop using drugs, but really they're just broke. Mm. And say they quit, I'm not using no more. But as soon as they get some money, they start using again. Some people have enough money to not get broke, or they'll get broke and start draining their family, but they'll die before they run out of money.
Right.
So it's a blessing that we poor and addicted than to be rich and addicted. That, you know, you see a lot of rich people dying because they can afford the death.
Well, we saw what happened to Prince.
Prince, John Belushi, I mean, hundreds of them, most of them, you know, they got money to...
Literally money to burn.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't stop. You can keep buying and keep until you kill yourself. Poor people... The pain of running out of money and being degraded so and going down so low forces you to stop. Mm. Pain become your teacher, you know. But if you got enough money, you don't learn. Mm. You just keep using.
Yeah.
So that's the only difference, because the principles of the disease applies to everybody. It affects humanity. It affects spirituality. It's the opposite, the polar opposite of spirituality. And we all are human, and we all have a spirit, but we all have a choice whether we want to develop that spirit or not. So money can keep you from finding yourself.
Mm-hmm. Because you can lose yourself in everything else that money can buy.
Right, because you got enough you can afford not to even think about it. Mm. And a lot of times you die before you run out of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, but to talk about a little bit, though, Israel, about, again, how that transition actually, what is it that you actually, when you talk about a lifestyle change, what is it that you're actually teaching people? Because I know you teach them a lot of things. I mean, a trade is one thing. But talk about it, like the program itself, as far as how you teach people to change their lifestyle, because ultimately that's what it comes down to.
Well, recovery unfolds in phases.
Okay.
And you can't skip no phases. Each phase prepare you for the next phase. First, you had to do first things first, and then second, then third. But you can't go from 1 to 10 and 1 to 5. Mm-hmm. You have to, each process prepares you for the next process. It's like a person that's doing all these different drugs and he stopped doing two of them. His spirit automatically shows up in his awareness. Like he might say, I need to take a bath. But if he was still using all those drugs, he would have been filled up with addictive thinking and he never thought about taking it. So that's a spiritual awareness is coming in. So the more addictive things you stop doing, the more spiritual awareness comes into your life. And so you operate off of what you already have, which is your conscience. It tells you what to do. But if something else is in the place of your conscience, then you're going to become whatever your adversary, adverse of the conscience, tell you. So it unfolds in phases until you get to the point where you have to start making your own choices. Life is difficult because in the difficulty, after going through difficulty, life gets easier. But if it's easy, then life gets worse. That's instant gratification going to bring you long-term pain. Short-term pain is going to bring you long-term pleasure. So you have to be willing to go through the difficulty to see what's on the other side. In the difficulty is your lesson, is your life learning. And then and on the other side is things get easy. We've been made endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. So after difficulty comes ease. So you can't do it by yourself because your thinking got you in the condition that you're in. You have to have some other people. And we are human. We have human potential, but we don't have to act like human beings. This is the duty of another human to uplift another human so that this is how, because we're interdependent. Right. So if we allow other people to fall, then eventually you may not be infected with the disease, but you're going to be affected. And you can't hide. So everybody need to try to pull everybody else up. But just like everything else, duality, there's adversity. It's always an adverse force that's trying to tear you down. I don't care what you're doing. Right. Everything is duality. So you got to stand up against forces attempting to tear you down. And you learn that by going through the recovery process. It's phases. We name the phases, transition, stabilization, early recovery, middle recovery, maintenance. So maintenance is recovery. We do recover. You have to maintain your recovery. That's life. That's difficult. But in recovery, difficult is something that's enjoyable in recovery if you have a life. You love challenges. You love to do things to bring out the best in you. But if you never knew what that was, then you thinking, in your way of thinking, it is something that you don't want to do. Because that word difficult scares people. So they back up off of it. And rather to go through the difficulty to see what's on the other side, they go back to what they know best.
You know, we don't have a lot of time left, but I think that the image of drug addiction in Baltimore City has been one that's been stereotypical for many years, and what you just explained adds more human dimension to what people are going through, and it's a lot easier for people just to stereotype us and say, well, yeah, that's what drug addiction looks like, right? But it becomes a more nuanced scenario when you deal with the reality, the fullness of what it really is all about.
Because nobody's exempt.
Right. That's the whole point.
Nah, it's affecting, you know, everybody. It don't discriminate against nobody. It's the principles and the laws that's going to apply to all humans. We got the same principles, the same law, the same creator, and we're on the same mold, everybody. So once a person begins to find out where he's at, then if it's a good place, then you don't want to do the opposite. If it's a bad place, you do the opposite of what you're doing because that's exactly where you want to be. So in Baltimore, our addiction tell us where we want to be. Now, in other places, they can see where they're going.
They see the example.
Right. But all we got to do is do the opposite of whatever we're doing right now. And it's all. So what we got to do is change the lifestyle of the children because they are future addicts. They, you know, it's easier to teach children than it is to repair grown people.
Indeed.
Because they got to learn. There's no cure for unlearned behavior.
Right. Israel Quezon is the founder of I Can't, We Can, the Addiction Recovery Facility. My friend, it's always good to see you, man, and we appreciate your wisdom, as always.
Thanks, y'all.
Yeah. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, second hour of First Edition, we are going to have a modified episode of the Hollywood All-Stars. We're going to be taking a look at the 2017 Stellar Music Awards. We'll be in here with Finesse Demps, one half of the Hollywood All-Stars. Also, Calais Event. She's a producer and host of Fresh Fire, the radio podcast Fresh Fire, talking about the Stellar Awards. And also the dual inspiration segment is coming up as well in the second hour, First Edition. Stay tuned.